You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Ray McGovern. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Ray, before we get started talking about John Brennan, who I guess assumed the office as the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, I just want to read a little bit from your bio from your new website for our listeners. I know a lot of the listeners are very much aware of who you are and what you've done, some of the great things you've done, but I just want to read directly from this, if I may. It's going to take a minute or two.
Sure.
Ray came from his native New York to Washington in the early 60s as an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and then served as a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. Ray's duties included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. In January 2003, Ray helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPs, or VIPs, to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. And of course, you are a member of Veterans for Peace. And for the benefit of the listeners, you served in the CIA for, was it about 27 years?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Ray, it's always a pleasure speaking with you and an honor. The listeners, like I said, I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware of your past and what you have done and what you continue to do in the cause of peace. Now, today, March 8th, is when John Brennan is assuming the position of CIA director. And as I mentioned just before the interview, it's timely that we're speaking. You have several articles on Brennan on your website, which is raymcgovern.com, and that's mcgovern.com. And one of them stood out to me, where you say, if you liked Cheney's dark side, you'll love Brennan. Why is Brennan the wrong guy to head the CIA, Ray?
Well, I'm tempted to ask how much time I have, but I'll leave that joke alone here. It's a long list, Dave. Most people know him from his endorsement of what he calls extraordinary rendition, what the rest of us call kidnapping. When he was asked on Lehrer, on NewsHour, why he thought kidnapping was a good idea, here's Margaret Warner. Do you think that extraordinary rendition is a vital tool to combat terrorism? Here's John Brennan. Quote, I think it's an absolutely vital tool. All I can say is it has produced intelligence that has saved lives. Now, those of your listeners who have watched the February 7th hearing realize that Brennan retracted that. He said, well, that's what they told me. They told me it saved lives. Now I've read the Senate investigation, and I realize I have to look at that. Last thing here. They asked John Brennan, well, why do you bring these people, why do you send them to other countries? And we know, to our disgrace, that 54 foreign countries cooperated in giving their airfields to this project. They said, well, why do you have to bring them to other countries? And John Brennan says, well, quote, quite frankly, I think it's rather arrogant to think that we are the best in every case in terms of eliciting information from terror suspects. Now, other countries have other services, and they have a long experience in dealing with this challenge because they're confronting terrorists on a day-to-day basis, end quote. Well, we know what that means, don't we? Other countries are much more adept at the torture techniques.
Exactly.
Pretty much novices on. So this guy is poison, both from an operational point of view, from a substantive point of view. Now, I was just thinking about the NewsHour and remembering that when heads of the CIA have changed in the past, I was asked on the NewsHour to comment. And that was from George Tenet to Porter Goss to Michael Hayden, and so forth. This time they forgot about me, and I think I know why. That being said, I've written an awful lot about Brennan because I know the guy. He was a young analyst, an inexperienced journeyman analyst on the Middle East when I was still working at the CIA. I've talked to a supervisor since, and they describe him as a failed analyst who really couldn't write very well. Analyzing was mediocre, so what he did was what so many others do, what Bobby Gates did. He insinuated himself into the White House, briefing third-tier folks, not the folks I briefed, but the people at third level. Among them were George Tenet, who later became the head of the CIA. And that's pretty much the story. He impressed Tenet. Tenet began to rely on John Brennan for whatever he needed done. And he ended up appointing him chief of station in Saudi Arabia on the strength of zero experience in operations and a claim to be able to speak Arabic. He came back and he became Tenet's chief of staff. And then he became deputy executive director so that he could be promoted even higher. Now, before we get into this business about torture and all the other things that have been focused on, I want to speak out of my own perspective here. And that is that people really need to know that there are two CIAs, okay? This is an accident of history, but it's very real and it persists to today. The one that Truman intended, and he was, of course, the one that established the CIA in 1947, was a body of experts and analysts who would tell him what was going on in the world, who could speak without fear or favor because they worked for him. They weren't working for the Pentagon or the State Department. They were his counselors, okay? The other thing, the key thing, of course, was that they would be in possession of all the information on a given subject or issue, therefore a central intelligence agency. Now, why is that central? No pun intended. That's central because Truman was painfully aware that if there were one central place before Pearl Harbor, where all the information from the code breakers and the FBI and the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army Air Corps, the embassy in Tokyo, if there was one inbox, in those days we had inboxes made of wood, the one inbox into which all that information came, Pearl Harbor would have not been a surprise. It would have been a no-brainer, okay? So Central Intelligence Agency, a place which would speak to President Truman without fear or favor, tell it like it is, and the one clandestine part of this agency would be the case officers who would run spies to collect intelligence not available in other ways, okay? Period. Now, what happened? At the end of World War II, home came incredibly imaginative, courageous, enterprising people from the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner for the operations part of the CIA. Now, they had worked miracles in the European theater in the Far East, jumping in behind enemy lines, overthrowing this or that titular government. And so when they came back in 46, 47, you know, I said, well, thanks very much for all the applause. And there was a lot of well-deserved applause. I said, well, now, do you think we should, well, should we hang around here? Or you still need us? Or should we go back to our law firms or operations or go back to academia? And the question answered itself. And here the Soviets had already overrun Eastern Europe. KGB was overthrowing governments around the world. So the answer was, of course we need you. Now, here's where some real, I have to choose my words carefully. Some real idiot entered the fray and said, hey, we're creating this analysis shop that Truman wants to be a central place for all analysis, but they're going to be dealing with some secret stuff because of their spies that would be giving them. Let's put these guys, who have to be secret too, let's put them in with the analysts. Big, big mistake. That was a structural fault from the beginning. And what it ended up with is having one director of the CIA who was responsible for A, the objective analysis to be given to the president, and B, as the thing evolved, overthrowing Guatemala, overthrowing the government in Iran, overthrowing the people in Chile, and running wars like the Contra War in Central America. And so, you know, what credibility does this director of Central Intelligence have when he goes up on the hill, or one of his minions goes up on the hill, and they say, well, do you think the Contra War is a good idea? Do you think it's going to be effective in the long run? Well, he's running a war. What's he going to say? So the degree of credulity to be assigned to the head of the CIA was diminished in value to the degree he was involved in operations. Now, that's all sort of handy background to just suggest that during my 27-year career on the analysis division side, I had career protection for speaking truth to power. Many two-star, three-star generals knows I knocked out a joint by telling it like we thought it was. LBJ. Hey, fellas, those generals with the blue suits on, they tell me they got this big new B-52 and some big, big bombs they would never have before, and they're going to seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and Ho Chi Minh is going to give up. What do you guys think? That's the way the system is supposed to work. The president comes to the CIA, and he says, what do you guys think?
Right.
Now, we suppressed a laugh. I mean, half of our guys knew that piece of history very well. Some of them were in Hanoi bringing Ho Chi Minh in on their shoulders. They knew, number one, that no one ever wins a war with bombing. Number two, it just strengthens the resistance and resolve of the people bombed. And number three, that no one least willing or least apt to surrender the bombing than Ho Chi Minh. We knew him. We knew him quite well. And so we waited a discreet interval and went back to LBJ and said, now, Mr. President, number one, you have to realize that the Ho Chi Minh Trail doesn't really look anything like I-95 or I-66. It's like 163 trails through the jungle. You can't even see most of it from the air. So as effective as these bombs are, unless they hit every square inch, you're not going to prevent the infiltration. And number two, we know Ho Chi Minh. Under no circumstances is he going to give up on the bombing. And we told him that. We told LBJ that, and he said, that's the corollary here. The president is not bound to accept the intelligence judgments. He's bound, or he thinks he's bound, by political considerations. He didn't want to be the first president to lose a war, and so he became the first U.S. president to lose a war. Now, fast forward from all that, and you get an ethos. You get a kind of atmosphere in the analysis part of the CIA that feels, you know, kind of, not smug, but there's sort of an elan there. We're going to speak truth to power no matter how many noses we put out of joint. And what happened? Well, Bill Casey came in as Director of Central Intelligence, head of the CIA, with Ronald Reagan in 1981. Now, Bill was a really bright guy. I used to brief him regularly. But he was a really bright guy and very good for countering all the Nazis. World War II, great guy, great spy master. For what happened after World War II, the more nuanced challenge of the Soviet Union, not very good. Not very good at all. So when he came in, he, number one, made sure that we got the word that the Soviet Union was responsible for all the terrorism in the world. Again, we suppressed the laugh, and we adduced many a memo to show Bill Casey, no, it's more complicated than that. In many respects, the Soviet Union fears terrorism just as much as we do. Well, those people got demoted. And then Casey turned his attention to the Soviets in Central America. Now, I'm going to symbolically speak here, Dave. He went down there to Nicaragua, and he kicked over a rock, and he said, ah, I see a Soviet under every rock here. And Bobby Gates, who incidentally worked for me as a young analyst of Soviet affairs, went down with him and kicked over another rock. Oh, Mr. Casey, I see there are three of them here. And somebody else saw five of them. Now, if you saw two of them, you became a division chief. If you saw five of them, you became an office chief. If you were like Bobby Gates, you became head of all analysis. And that's precisely what happened. A little bit exaggerated, but not by much. What right. did he do? He threw out all the people who knew about the Soviet Union, like my colleague Noel Goodman, who often is commenting these days and writes books, and he substituted malleable managers, the kind that were interested more in their careers, more in getting ahead their promotions than they were about telling the truth. Why do I say all this? Well, because by 2002, when the flag was going up on Iraq, and people wanted to know, what is this, all this business about Iraq being a threat? Did it really have a hand in what happened in 9/11 and all this stuff? What had bubbled to the top in the CIA over the 21 previous years, and that's how long it takes to politicize or corrupt an institution.
Wow.
Those people were sort of malleable, is what I say. So Tenet had them sort of in his pocket. He had promoted them. He was responsible for their careers. And so what Tenet did, and who's George Tenet? Well, he was the director of the CIA there for those crucial years. What he was avoiding was any national intelligence estimate. Now, that's the supreme genre of analytic product, okay? It's subscribed to by all the agencies, 16 of them now, and signed by the director. He resisted preparing such a document. Why? Because he was very clear that an honest document would have said weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We don't see any evidence of that. It beats the hell out of us. And that, of course, is not what Dick Cheney wanted to hear.
Right.
Dick Cheney went and spoke before the Veterans of Foreign Wars on the 26th of August, 2002, and that's where he said Iraq has all manner of chemical and biological warfare, munitions. They have reconstituted their nuclear development program for weapons. They are involved with terrorists. And, you know, if you think the UN inspectors can help this, don't be deceived. They just give you a false sense of security. Whole nine yards, he laid it out there before people got back to Washington for Labor Day. So when they came back from Washington, it was clear to Congress even, the sleeping Congress, that Bush wanted to start a war against Iraq. We had a sleepy fellow who was head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. His name was Bob Graham. He was from Florida. What's he doing? Well, he's arranging his own presidential campaign. Okay? He's going to run for president. So he's sort of asleep at the wheel. But Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, he says, Bob, you know, I understand that the administration wants to do a vote on whether we should attack Iraq. And it's all about this weapons of mass destruction. Have you seen any estimate on that from the CIA? And Graham says, I don't know. It's odd, isn't it? Well, Bob, why don't you call George Tenet and ask him where the estimate is? Oh, you think, yeah, okay. Hello, George. We need an estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If you want us to proceed on this, we are the Senate Intelligence Committee, after all. Okay. He hangs up. Durbin. What do you say? Bob Graham. Well, he said they're awful busy these days, and he won't have time to do an estimate on weapons of mass destruction. So Durbin says, Bob, you call that guy up, and you tell him no estimate on weapons of mass destruction, no vote on a war against Iraq. So Graham does that, okay? And Tenet says, oh, the die is cast now. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to do an estimate. He goes down to the White House. I'm not sure he went down to the White House right now, but certainly he contacted the White House, and he said, what do I do? Should I do an estimate? And the answer was, yeah, it looks like I have to do an estimate, but just two requirements here. Number one, it's got to come out exactly the way Dick Cheney portrayed the situation on the 26th of August, so just a month ago. And number two, it's got to be done in 2 weeks because we want to get this off and running before the midterm elections because no congressman or senator is going to have the guts to vote against a resolution that puts Iraq in the crosshairs. So what did Tenet do? He salutes, and he goes back to his director's conference room, where I've spent many more hours than I can count. And I can just visualize them sitting around the table there. And Tenet comes back, and he says, well, men and women, I have this, I got the word from the White House, there's going to be an estimate on Iraq. We can't duck it any longer. But it's got to be done in 2 weeks, and it's got to come to the same conclusions as Cheney did in his speech just 2 weeks ago. Now, Dave, if that happened in our day, it would have been... George, right. Oh, George, that's a really good one. George, you're not serious. And if he said he was serious, we would have been the heck out of that conference room. Now, there may have been one or two that stayed behind, but he would have known that he had an insurrection or a mutiny on his hands.
Right.
But in view of what I've described as the corruption, the gradual politicization of the analysis directive, never mind the operations folks. Sitting around that table were a bunch of malleable managers who saluted and said, 2 weeks? Sure, we can do that, sir. You got to come out? Yep, we can do it. And out of that process came the very worst intelligence estimate in U.S. intelligence history. There's only one that rivals it, Dave, and that was the one that we all did in September of 1962, which very confidently predicted that the Russians would never try to put missiles in Cuba because they knew how we would react, right? Well, we were wrong, of course, but that was an honest mistake, okay? What's come out in the subsequent years after the estimate on Iraq is that this was not some sort of mistake. This was fraud. This was very, very, very deep fraud to include what Jay Rockefeller, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said was intelligence that was, quote, unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent, period, end quote. And I ask you, what's non-existent intelligence look like? Forgeries? So why all this? Well, because Brennan was right there. He was a Tenet's right-hand man, okay? He was the deputy executive director when most of this was going on, and he was also Tenet's chief of staff. So it beggars belief that Brennan was completely oblivious of the fact that the main purpose of the CIA, tell the president the truth without fear or favor, had been, what's the word, prostituted by George Tenet and others who thought that if President Bush wanted to make a war in Iraq, it was our job to serve up, to conjure up, to forge the kind of intelligence that would deceive our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that, Dave, and John Brennan sat right in the midst of that. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just finish up here on John Brennan today, because this is really important. Now, when he was testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I'm talking about the 7th of February, just last month, he said something that was really, really striking because it didn't square with what the intelligence community is saying. What he said was, Iran is bent on obtaining nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile delivery systems to deliver them. Now... Hello? You might see that in the New York Times. You might see that in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. You will never see that in any intelligence document because after the debacle in Iraq, after the fraudulent national intelligence estimate on Iraq, we got some honest blood into the intelligence community in the form of a fellow named Tom Finger from the State Department. He was head of their State Department intelligence, and they asked him to do an honest job. not a fraudulent job, but an honest job on Iran, whom we all knew was in the crosshairs of the Bush-Cheney administration. So what was their task? Well, their task was not to review all documents, not to review all the analysis, but to go bottom up, look at all the evidence that there is, including new evidence that they were lucky enough to get. And they worked all during 2007, Dave, the whole year, okay? As new things came in, they delayed the appearance of this estimate. But in November 2007, they concluded, and I hope your listeners listen to this carefully, the 16 intelligence agencies of the U.S. government unanimously expressed with, quote, high confidence, end quote, concluded that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003 and not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Now, you know, do the arithmetic here. It's almost 10 years ago, right? Now, was that a sort of an outlier sort of view? No, it was by all 16 intelligence agencies, and every year since, so 2008, 9, 10, every year since, it's been revalidated, reiterated by the chief of all intelligence. Now he's called the Director of National Intelligence, and the CIA director comes under him. So Brennan has to know that, or else he's guilty of misfeasance to a fare-thee-well. That estimate stopped the war. Now, I've been around 50 years, Dave, and I've never seen a national intelligence estimate that I could adequately describe as having played a huge role in stopping a war. There were other factors. There was our military that did not want to get involved in a war with Iran, and they pressed very hard against it. But until the arrival of this estimate, it looked like, very much like, and we can see that this is true, Bush and Cheney had intended to join Israel in attacking Iran during Bush and Cheney's last year in office, 2008. Now, how do I know that? Don't believe McGovern, okay? Go to the library and get Bush's memoir, okay? Decision Points, he calls it. Go to page 419, and you'll see, he must have written these pages himself, okay? You'll see what he says. He says, that was a bombshell. That estimate came out of nowhere. I had just said that our biggest challenge was Iran working on nuclear weapons, and I was really acerbic about it. I said, what do you want? World War III? Is that what you want? To these dumb reporters. And now they pull the rug right out from under me. And this is a direct quote. This deprived me. This tied my hands from the military option. And then this wonderful paragraph, quote, how could I authorize our armed services to attack a country when the intelligence community says that country has no active nuclear weapons program? Question mark. End quote. Hello.
Wow. So he must have written that himself, right?
Bummer, you know? Bummer.
Wow.
You would have thought that that conclusion, the appropriate reaction would have been, are you guys sure? You mean they stopped? Oh, man, you better check that evidence. This up, we'll tell the Israelis, don't worry about it anymore. instead, Bush went over to Tel Aviv the next month and apologized, and said he didn't agree with the estimate. But the die was cast. The estimate was enough to prevent this war, and so Bush and Cheney were not able to march off into the sunset, having perpetrated what they wanted to do against Iran. One last thing about Brennan and his seeming lack of smarts. You know about these drones, and you know that it was revealed that the New York Times knew many months ago that Brennan had been instrumental in setting up a base for these drones in where? In Saudi Arabia. And actually, the hit on the American citizen Awlaki was not from that base. They assassinated an American citizen without due process from that base in Saudi Arabia. Now, what's the big deal about bases in Saudi Arabia? Well, we know that that was one of the main factors that Osama bin Laden and his ilk cited. U.S. foreign military presence in the land of the sacred sites of Islam, not a good idea. And so his Brennan, without any reference to what happened before 9/11, starting the whole process again with U.S. military bases in Saudi Arabia. Now, why would he be intent on following this policy of drone warfare, targeted killings, assassinations? Well, either he's really dumb, or he recognizes the ultimate effect of this, which is to create still more terrorists, and has fallen in with those who say, well, you know, we got the military, we get more terrorists, or we'll just kill more. And, you know, it's really, really good. You know, you talk about who profits, cui bono, it's really, really good for the guys that make the drones, the guys who make the Hellfire missiles, the guys who build the other weapons that get destroyed and you have to replenish them. The military-industrial complex aided and abetted by Congress, who was in their employ, and by the mainstream media. I remember what the definition of fascism is, Dave, and we're coming very, very close to that, because most Americans have no idea of what's really going on there. So we can talk a little bit more about the dark side of John Brennan, having to do with these extraordinary renditions and black prisons abroad and the torture, which is all just as real. But a lot of that has already been aired, and so I thought I would try to chime in with the substantive problems here. If Brennan comes in and fools around with the considered judgment of 16 intelligence agencies and says to the president what he said to Dianne Feinstein's committee, namely, Iran is bent on acquiring nuclear weapons and ICBMs. If he does that, it's just a very short step, because Congress would just love to give Iran a bloody nose. It won't be a bloody nose. A war with Iran would make the war with Iraq look like a volleyball game between Mount St. Ursula and St. Helena's High School. It would be a disaster. And so Brennan comes in and starts to curry favor with the neocons. And how else do you explain why he said what he said before the Feinstein Committee? There's real trouble here. That aside from all these targeted assassinations and the prospect that the president isn't even willing to rule out doing a drone hellfire strike on you and me, Dave.
You mentioned, of course, a couple of times Israel. Are they continually behind the scenes egging these type of actions on? Is that something that people should be paying close attention to, what Israel wants?
Well, yes. If you look at Iran, I mean, we had our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, 3 years ago in answering Q&A-type questions in Doha, okay? And she's asked, now, what do you think that Iran's such a big threat to you guys? And she says, oh, no, Iran is certainly not a threat to the United States, but could be a threat to our allies. Now, that's a rare admission. If Iran is not a threat to the United States, then who are these allies that it's a threat to? Well, the allies, plural, becomes really just one, Israel. Now, visualize this. Israel has, most people think, between 50 and 300 nuclear weapons. They're deliverable by air, sea, underwater, aircraft, missiles. And the notion that the Iranians would threaten Israel with one or two nuclear weapons, well, the best way I can depict that, I think, is Jacques Chirac, the French president, was asked this question 2 years ago. Actually, it was a big press conference, New York Times, Herald Tribune, Le Monde, and they're sitting there, and the same question came up. Monsieur le President, you think that the Iranians would use their weapon or threaten to use a weapon against Israel? You could see it on tape. He says, mon Dieu, this missile, it would go 500 meters in the air and the rest of Iran would be in ashes. And then he said the French equivalent of, give me a break. Okay.
Good accent, by the way, Ray.
Well, thanks. But you know what happened? 2 days later, he recanted. He said, I never said that. And they said, oh, Monsieur le President, he's on the tape. And he's, oh, well, I didn't mean to say that. So that's how powerful the Israel lobby is, not only here, but in France. He had to say he didn't say it, even though Dick said he said. So the good news is that with the appointment and confirmation of Secretary Chuck Hagel, a new era is born. This time, the Israeli lobby was unable to dissuade Barack Obama from doing the right thing. And Obama shows some signs now of, I don't know how to explain it. Maybe he got a spine implant from GW Hospital over the holidays and Christmas. But he's standing up to these guys, and he's saying, look, our interests are not always identical, and we do undertake and we promise to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. But Ehud Barak, the Israeli defense minister, just 3 days ago before the UN said, we need to prevent the Iranians from getting a nuclear capability, or we have to prevent their aspirations. Now, hello, they already have a nuclear capability. They have the gaseous diffusion, they have the centrifuges there, and they can make nuclear power. They can't make nuclear weapons without further refinement. But aspirations? Well, how do you know that they have these aspirations? All I can say is that if the U.S. intelligence community is right, that they stopped working on a nuclear weapon 10 years ago, that's a very, very strange way to have these aspirations, right? So it seems to me that Barack Obama has made a turn here, partly because Netanyahu overplayed his hand. Netanyahu thought he had a real strong hand before the U.S. election. That's when he was threatening to do the job himself, knowing, and this is 95% certain, that the U.S. would have had to come in and clean up after him, okay, if he attacked Iran. Now, what happened was, and many people like myself were calling on the president, look, Mr. President, he thinks he's going to do this, and he's going to expect you to come on, unless you tell him not to, publicly. You got to come on publicly. So on August 30th, 2012, Martin Dempsey, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, apropos of not much else, he said, you know, quote, I don't want to be complicit if the Israelis attack Iran, end quote. Whoa, that's the next best thing for the president to say of himself, all right? That was it. That was the denouement. That was very different from what the president said the previous February at the Super Bowl, saying, we're going to march in lockstep with the Israelis no matter what they do. So there has been a turn. And the situation of Israel is very much more precarious than it has been before, largely because of the Arab Spring, largely because they cannot count on a docile ally in Egypt anymore being bought off by the United States, and also because young Jewish folks in this country are facing up to the reality that the lobbies like AIPAC are not doing anyone any favors, that Israel really needs to face reality if it is to persist as a nation state over the longer term.
I just want you to comment on this, Ray. In the news just this past week, a Republican congressman in the House introduced a resolution to support an Israeli strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. It says here, the non-binding resolution introduced Tuesday by Representative Paul Gosar, Republican Arizona, fully supports Israel's lawful exercise of self-defense, including actions to halt Iranian aggression, such as a strike against Iran's illegal nuclear program. And another 12 Republicans are co-sponsors. It says a non-binding Senate resolution introduced last week in time for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's annual conference calls on President Obama to support Israel logistically should Israel feel compelled to strike Iran to stop its suspected bomb-making. And then on Tuesday, Senators Barbara Boxer, Democrat California, and Roy Blunt, Republican Missouri, introduced the Senate version of another House bill introduced last week in time for AIPAC's conference that would designate Israel a major strategic ally, a one-of-a-kind definition, of course, while Americans are going hungry and living on the streets. Do you think that these bills, these resolutions, have the ability to pass?
Well, what you're seeing is the power of money, pure and simple, and some misguided notions about what's good for Israel. Let's take the definition of ally. I think I may have been the only person to testify before Congress within the last decade, as I did in June of 2005, by saying this. You keep referring to Israel as an ally. That's not really quite true. Look it up in your Funken-Wagnall. Look it up in your Google Dictionary. An ally is a country that is bound to another country by a mutual defense treaty, period. Okay. Now, is there a mutual defense treaty between Israel and the United States? Most people think there must be, but there isn't. The answer is no. And the explanation is that after the Arabs did attack Israel in 73, Kissinger and others offered a mutual defense treaty to Israel. You know, he said, you know, the best way to prevent this from happening again is you get us involved there and they won't dare touch it, okay? And what did the Israelis say? They said, thank you very much, but no thanks. Why? Two reasons. Number one, they didn't want to have to deal with internationally recognized boundaries, which are the sine qua non for a mutual defense treaty. They didn't want to deal with the occupied territories, and that would have had to come up in these negotiations. Number two, things are going just fine for the Israelis without being literal allies, because every senator and representative refers to them as allies anyway. American people will think they're allies. And so, you know, if you have a real alliance, well, that sort of binds each side to, well, to agree if they're going to hit out after another country like Lebanon or Syria or Gaza. You know, it's sort of really good to notify your ally ahead of time. The Israelis didn't want any part of that. And so they said, thank you very much, really nice sentiment, but we don't need your mutual defense treaty. And that's why it's literally wrong to talk about Israel being our ally. Now, you know, I could add a little semi-joke here, but I'll do it just to prove a point. They were offering Israel the status of the 51st state of the United States, but Israel turned it down. And the other person says, well, why would they turn it down? And the answer was, well, then they'd only have two senators. Now, that's funny, maybe, but in reality, when you see these very noxious, when you see these resolutions that don't give any regard to the poor folks that are subject to this poverty draft that is peopling our armed forces, when you're willing to squander personal human beings like that in a war against a country that does not threaten us and does not threaten Israel, that's as bad as it gets. Now, I think Obama feels more secure now than he did last year, but these congressional resolutions can really, really warp things. And if you get John Brennan as head of the CIA to play with Congress rather than with the president and the executive, you've got a much more dangerous situation, and the danger of miscalculation grows exponentially. I don't know. I have no idea. Well, I do have some suggestions as to why Obama would have picked him.
Can I ask you about that?
Well, you know, Brennan knows where the bodies are buried. And if you look back at the heroic efforts of George H.W. Bush to get Bobby Gates confirmed as a CIA director, extraordinary efforts. I never could quite understand it. 31 people voted against Gates, okay? 34 had voted against Brennan in the Senate. Why was that? Well, it's very clear to me in retrospect, and because I work with Bob Perry, who knows more about this than anybody else, that Gates and George H.W. Bush were up to their necks in Iran-Contra, up to their necks in the whole operation. And once George H.W. Bush could get Bobby Gates confirmed as CIA director, the cover-up was signed, sealed, and delivered. That explains it quite adequately for me, and the evidence is compelling. So why would Obama want Brennan in this kind of place? Well, I think he believes, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, that Brennan owes him the kind of loyalty that he has come to depend on from other advisors, and that no matter what happens in the CIA, he'll tell the president about it. And if there's a plot in the CIA to do him in, his loyalties will be with the White House, not like what happened before John Kennedy was assassinated. Not like what happened before Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Now, this time, he's got Brennan in place. Anything like that, Brennan will tell him about before it happens. Well, I exaggerate not. Just add one little anecdote, and that is that I know that at a dinner of maybe 12 progressives, a dinner with Obama, and this just goes back 3 years, they were pressing him, why don't you do more on the progressive side? Why don't you do more? And finally, he threw up his hands and he says, because I remember what happened to Dr. King. That's why. Put it all together there. If your conclusion is that the President of the United States is afraid of the CIA, then you can maybe understand a little better why he would pick a person with this kind of background, this kind of reputation, thinking that his thug will prevent other thugs from doing him in.
Ray, as is always the case, incredible insight. I want to thank you so much for the time you took out to explain all this to the listeners. And I'm really honored to speak to you, Ray, and thank you for elaborating on this, because this is information that you really can't get from anywhere other than from somebody who's been in the trenches and has seen exactly how this organization operates. Thanks so much, Ray.
You're most welcome.